Stephen Hawking writes a book. David Weston quits his job. Barbara Boxer says, no, ma'am. Educators debate study habits. Parents are told to go home. And the New York Times takes a new look at God and politics. It's September 7, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. This new book by Stephen Hawking is sure to get a great deal of attention. It's entitled The Grand Design, and it is, like his earlier book, A Brief History of Time, destined to get a great deal of attention and to become something of a topic of cultural conversation. By any measure, Stephen Hawking is one of the most famous and influential figures in modern science. For 30 years, he served as Lucasian Professor of Mathematics at the University of Cambridge. His career before and after his decades in that post are the stuff of scientific legend. He is probably also the individual who has been longest living after a diagnosis with ALS. The very fact that he has been so productive since that diagnosis at age 21 is a testimony to a sense of personal mission and sheer determination. Now, in this new book, The Grand Design, Stephen Hawking, along with co-author Leonard Mlodinow, now press the case against God, or at least against any role for God in the origin of the universe or the beginning of time. Stephen Hawking has always been one to ask big questions. Why is there something, for instance, rather than nothing? But he not only asks them, he seeks to answer them. And in The Grand Design, Stephen Hawking and Leonard Mlodinow seek to do just that, to look at the big question, why is there something rather than nothing, and answer it without any reference to God, and explicitly, not just the absence of any reference to God, but the argument that God is irrelevant to the process. Just in case you wondered where they were headed in this book, in a preview article published over the weekend in the Wall Street Journal, Hawking and Mlodinow summarized their case against God. After acknowledging the incredible fine-tuning of the universe that was necessary for conscious human life, they then go on to describe these coincidences, that's their word, in terms of a spontaneous creation without God. No evidence here, they say, for the work of a creator. To the contrary, they conclude that science and science alone can provide all the necessary answers. Quote, as recent advances in cosmology suggest, the laws of gravity and quantum theory allow universes to appear spontaneously from nothing, they write. Spontaneous creation is the reason there is something rather than nothing, why the universe exists, why we exist. It is not necessary to invoke God to light the blue torch paper and set the universe going. End quote. Now, the headline of their article, Why God Did Not Create the Universe, pulls no punches. Now, newspapers and media outlets across the globe announced that Stephen Hawking has now come out against belief in God. But a closer look at the evidence suggests that this is actually nothing new for Professor Stephen Hawking. All the major arguments presented in The Grand Design have appeared earlier in Hawking's previous books or in interviews. Now, as has been observed by others, Stephen Hawking tends to deploy arguments about God when he wants to sell books. Nevertheless, given his stature and influence, his ideas are worth careful attention. Now, as you look to The Grand Design, you'll note that his major thrusts, his major arguments, have to do with the fact that he now subscribes to what he calls M-theory, a superstring theory about the origins of matter that encompasses a host of theories and predictions about the nature of matter and time. Most importantly, this theory allows Hawking and Mlodinow to advance Hawking's theory that space and time have no boundary. If such a boundary did not exist, then God is not necessary. If a boundary does exist, then God might be the causal explanation. But, as Hawking now insists, there is no boundary and there is no God. Or at least, there's no creator. Now, Hawking also believes that there are countless universes and that the laws of physics on each might be radically different. But when he looks at this universe, our universe, he argues for spontaneous creation. Spontaneous creation is the reason there is something rather than nothing, he explains. And spontaneous creation means that the world simply is. There is no explanation for why it is. Now, interestingly enough, in his 1988 bestseller, A Brief History of Time, Stephen Hawking made very similar arguments. He received also strikingly similar press coverage. Quote, so long as the universe had a beginning, we could suppose it had a creator, he explained then. But Hawking rejected the very idea of a beginning as such, and he actually dispensed with the need for any creator. Now, Carl Sagan, the late astronomer, wrote an infamous introduction to Stephen Hawking's book, A Brief History of Time. Sagan argued that given Hawking's research and predictions, there is, quote, nothing left for a creator to do. Now, oddly enough, when A Brief History of Time was reissued for a 10th anniversary edition, Sagan's introduction was deleted. But Sagan, speaking of Hawking's first and most famous bestseller, A Brief History of Time, said, quote, this is a book about God, or perhaps about the absence of God. Interestingly, Stephen Hawking has acknowledged that his scientific work is, quote, on the borderline between science and religion. He went on to say, I've tried to stay on the scientific side of the border, end quote. We'd have to say that it looks like Professor Hawking has crossed that border many more times than he may even be consciously aware of. When he goes to speaking about cosmology, when he proceeds to explain the universe, he is, of necessity, speaking theology. Now, there is something important here that we need to note. Evangelical Christians need to see that what Stephen Hawking is doing here is eradicating any room for a God of the gaps. Now, if you've not heard that expression before, you need to know what it means. As modern science developed, some theologians sought to use God as the explanation for what science could not discover or uncover. Thus, they would suggest that when science ran out of energy and it ran out of theory, what was left was God. God was the one who started the whole process. God was the one who guided this process or that process. But as science pressed back through discovery and prediction and theory, well, the God of the gaps was found to have fewer gaps to inhabit. It's a reminder to us that evangelicals can find no refuge whatsoever in a God of the gaps. Entering into this form of logic, which is very typical of a naturalistic form of theology or of some forms of theological liberalism, is an endless process of theological surrender negotiation. It is no way to do theology. It is no way to defend belief in God. If you enter the game on those terms, you'll fall prey to Stephen Hawking's very poignant and pointed criticisms. The God of the Bible is not merely a first cause. He is the sovereign creator and sustainer of all that is. He rules the universe by his word. Christians must recognize that the God of the gaps is a false idol of theological surrender. The other thing we need to note from this book is that Stephen Hawking's worldview really matters, as our own worldview really does matter. His worldview is a positivistic scientism. He genuinely believes that science and science alone can provide the answers to all the big questions. Interestingly, in this new book, The Grand Design, he actually declares that philosophy is dead. In other words, science is all that remains. Now, in his 1980 inaugural address at Cambridge University, Hawking proposed that the great project of theoretical physics might be concluded by the end of the 20th century. He said, by this, I mean that we might have a complete, consistent, and unified theory of the physical interactions which would describe all possible observations. End quote. That's quite an audacious claim. But Stephen Hawking is quite an audacious thinker. He is a remarkable human being. His courage and tenacity are an inspiration to all. His work on the theory of gravity has changed the way the field of physics is taught. But when he crosses the border from science to theology, his worldview leads him into abject disaster. The Grand Design is yet another attempt to celebrate the universe's breathtaking design while denying the existence of a designer. It will not be the last. An interesting piece of news came out from the Associated Press tonight that ABC News President David Weston is going to step down, his resignation anticipated as early as this morning. David Weston has been the president of ABC News for the last 13 years, and he is stepping down in something of a conflict between himself and the management of the network. Now, what's really interesting about this is that this particular transition in the network news is a reminder to us not of how much the networks really matter, but of how now they matter so much less than they did in the past. Go back 20 years and the three news networks, CBS, NBC, and ABC, dictated what we heard and learned in the news. But that monopoly is over. And even as there is now this transition at ABC News and the future of that particular network is now up for grabs, The reality is that news programming is not now the monopoly of three networks and just a few newspapers and leading news sources and media outlets. It's now something that is a free-for-all, an open media circus, a blogosphere, and the World Wide Web that is filled with information. Some major news stories are breaking, of all things, on Twitter rather than on the news networks. And these days, social media is as much a part of the media environment as the old mainline media of the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, CBS, NBC, and yes, ABC. Another interesting aspect of this is the fact that ABC News does not have allied cable networks, such as its competitors have. NBC has MSNBC and CNBC. It's a reminder these days that synergy in news is important. But for evangelical Christians, I hope the reminder is that we need to be very careful interpreters and consumers of the news. We need to be very crucially careful, very critical, and thinking with our minds engaged as we indeed engage the media. The changes going on right now at ABC News are just a microcosm of the changes going on virtually every day in the larger media environment, and that's an environment in which we have quite a stake. The New York Times is out with an interesting article by Benedict Carey indicating that we're now being told that a lot of what we had been told about study habits just wasn't so. Scientific research fails to confirm a great deal of what educators have been saying about study. Now, you can read the article for yourself, the New York Times published over the weekend, but I'll tell you one very interesting aspect of this is it's clear that gimmicks don't work. When it comes to study, here's something you really didn't need scientific confirmation to know. Hard work leads to greater retention. Parents, you are right about that one. Now, interestingly, in looking at this, parents are being told it's time to go home from college. Colleges are reporting that one of their challenges these days is actually getting college students' parents to leave the students and go home. This generation of helicopter parents, very close to their children, and let's be thankful, children very close to their parents, by and large, is having a much harder time cutting the strings and leaving the kids on the college campus. One very interesting reason given for this difficulty in letting go is that many of these parents really wish they were the students themselves. They are remembering their college experience and wishing they could do it all over again. Well, let's remember, kids are kids and parents are parents. It's important we know the difference. A good deal of media attention has been given of late to Barbara Boxer, the senator from California, who told a brigadier general in a hearing that he should not refer to her as ma'am, but rather as senator. Quote, "I worked so hard to get that title," she said. "I'd appreciate it. Yes, thank you." End quote. Well, what's interesting out of this is that the New York Times has looked at the whole question of this word, ma'am, this title of respect and indeed of gentility, and in an article entitled "The Politics of Polite" by Natalie Angier, it argues that a good number of women, especially feminists, don't like the word at all. Now, I won't debate all of the linguistics involved here, but I'll tell you this. There's something important about saying yes, sir, and yes, ma'am. And there's something about those titles of respect that indicate two things that from a Christian worldview perspective are really important. Number one is the reality of gender. There's a difference between a sir and a ma'am. The other is the issue of respect. It is good that we respect those who are worthy of that respect, who by age and service and distinction and office deserve being told yes, sir, rather than just yes, or no, ma'am, rather than just no. When we lose that gentility and politeness and respect, when we lose that distinction between a man and a woman, we're losing more than language some would merely claim to be antiquated. Sam Tannehouse at the New York Times, in an article entitled "God and Politics Together Again," is looking at the fact that many persons thought that the election of President Barack Obama meant the end to all debate over religion and politics. It turned out that it's been anything but. What's interesting about Sam Tannehouse's article is that he quotes Andrew Sullivan, who, speaking of President Barack Obama, says, quote, "He is not born again. His faith, at once real and measured, hot and cool, lives at the center of the American religious experience," end quote. In other words, President Obama, who has claimed and identified himself as a Christian, has not been using the kind of language, the kind of argument, the kind of narrative that would help Christians to understand what kind of Christian he is. It's going to be interesting to see how this story develops, but it should be of interest to all Christians that the New York Times understands there is a difference in the way Christians describe themselves and, for that matter, understand Christianity. It says something that the national media, as illustrated by the old gray lady, the venerable New York Times, is trying to figure all this out, along with the rest of us. It's another reminder that the issue of religion and politics won't go away, especially when it comes to elections, because Christians, indeed virtually all Americans, know that leadership and convictions are inseparable. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. I'm Albert Moeller. I hope you'll listen every day, Monday through Friday, to this podcast. I hope you'll also go to my website at albertmoeller.com, where you will find a wealth of material that should be resources for you and your family. You'll also want to follow regular updates at Twitter. That's twitter.com/Albert Moeller. You'll also want to go to the website of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. That's www.sbts.edu. You'll find their information on programs, faculty, and the passions that characterize this institution. You'll also want to know about Southern Seminary Preview Day on October 15th. You can find out more at sbts.edu. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. I'm Albert Moeller. I'll meet you tomorrow.